This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
This episode is brought to you by Rockstar Energy Drink. Be honest, are you procrastinating by listening to this podcast? It's okay. You just need Rockstar Focus. Choose from three delicious flavors, each crafted with ingredients for an ideal energy and mental boost, like Lion's Mane, 200 milligrams of caffeine, and zero sugar. Visit rockstarenergy.com to learn more. At least 75 milligrams of caffeine has been shown to help improve attention.
This episode is brought to you by Twizzlers. Long day, late night, feeling a little bored? Twizzlers is the ultimate sidekick for any moment of the day, no matter what kind of day you're having. The perfect level of sweet and a fun excuse to sit back and relax. Unwind with Twizzlers. To buy now, visit Hersheyland.com/Twizzlers.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Hello, I'm Kellyanne Taylor, and this is the Radio Times podcast. Every week, I sit down with a celebrity guest from the world of TV or film to talk about their lives, both on and off screen. To my fellow TV enthusiasts, I hope you enjoy listening. This week, I'm joined by the actor Theo James. He grew up in Buckinghamshire, the youngest of five siblings, and dreamed of a career as a musician. After reading philosophy at the University of Nottingham, he segued into acting, enrolling as a student at the Bristol Old Vic Theatre. He catapulted to fame when he landed the leading role of Fall in the YA Hollywood hit series Divergent. Since then, he has starred in The White Lotus, Sanditon, The Time Traveller's Wife, and most recently, Guy Ritchie's The Gentleman. In this episode, he talks about the harsh realities of overnight fame, how the Me Too movement has shaped film sets, and how his latest role exposes Britain's class system. Theo James, welcome to the Radio Times podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start with, what is the view from your sofa? Talk me through your living room setup.
The view from my sofa, we've got young kids, so we don't have a TV downstairs. We have a TV upstairs in a room, and it's not a huge TV, although my brother's obsessed with like 70-inch TVs. He always chastises me. And there's a lovely yellow chair in the corner. There's some wood floor. There's a nice bay window, and there's some pictures.
Okay. You said there you have young children. Mm. So who gets control of the remote? Often it tends to be young kids.
Yes, I would say, yeah, my daughter now, you know, she's approaching four, and she wears the trousers in the house, so she definitely controls it.
Is there anything you've been watching recently that you've enjoyed?
In terms of children, that's what I watch mostly. But no, I do love, as everyone does, Bluey. I think it's incredibly well written and actually brings a tear genuinely to my eye often when I watch it. My daughter likes it, but I think I like it even more. But no, in terms of my watching, we've been obsessed with Succession and Matthew McFadden in that.
When you're watching TV, do you often think, oh, wish I could have been in that, or I want a role like that, or I want to work with this person, or are you actually genuinely able to switch off and just enjoy?
It's a good question. I think the longer you work in this industry, I guess, the more it's harder to maintain distance from it, and separate yourself from seeing, you know, lighting or hearing ADR and those kind of things. But it means that when you see something that is exceptional, you are completely transported. And you know, those kind of seminal TV films, or, you know, I watched Maestro. I love that movie. I thought it was beautifully directed and incredibly well made.
Did you watch it with or without subtitles?
No subtitles, no.
I really struggled.
Did you?
I really struggled to understand what they were saying. And I thought it was beautiful.
Yeah.
But I was a bit like, we seem to be in the era of the mumble. And I'm struggling.
We've been in the era of the mumble for a long time. I think, you know, the whisper generation began probably in the 90s. But yeah, I just thought it was beautifully shot.
Any TV turnoffs, so things that you just won't go near, like genres, for example?
What will I not go near? I understand the switch off ability of, you know, reality TV, but it can be on and I dislike it deeply, but then I'm instantly drawn into it in a way. So it's kind of a double-edged sword there. Yeah,
absolutely. Okay, let's rewind it back to your childhood. So you grew up in Buckinghamshire, one of five.
Yeah.
What's your first TV memory?
I think Thomas the Tank Engine, genuinely. I think that was my first TV memory. Loved Thomas. But in terms of a specific TV memory, it was different back then, wasn't it? Mm. I don't know. TV didn't play like a huge role in our house until when I was maybe 12 or 13, and it was the neighbors and Home and Away post-school kind of watch. That was big in our household, massive.
So TV wasn't a massive family affair?
It wasn't, no, because five kids, you know, very kind of havoc-inducing in a fun way. But, you know, and there was only four channels or whatever, five channels. So it didn't play and my parents aren't massive TV devourers, or gobblers, should we say. So no, it didn't play a huge part. Films did. My brother was a massive film fan, and he kind of led all of us through. He's the eldest of the five, and he was always into film, and he's got a great knowledge of film, and he still does. So he kind of would introduce the family to a very wide range of you know, classic 90s action to horror to, you know, art house. You know, he was kind of the way we came to film as a family.
And how does the view from your sofa as a child differ to now? So I often ask this question when I'm doing the podcast, because it's a great time to reflect on how this industry can change your life. And am I right in thinking that you grew up in a farmhouse, not farmland, but...
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, like an old farmhouse that had, you know, the land had been sold off years ago, but it was kind of 650 years old. It was an old, kind of beautiful, ramshackle, slightly falling down place, but with great memories and hundreds of animals that were constantly trying to survive and often not getting eaten by, you know, foxes or whatever. How has it changed? Well, I think in a nice way, again, as a family, we weren't hugely, we loved TV and film, but it wasn't at the center of our house. And I think that's probably the same now. Not that we don't watch TV, we watch it a lot and we enjoy it. But in terms of its kind of, you know, symbolic place in the home, it's not the center.
Let's talk about how you get into acting. Where does this come along? Because you do philosophy at university.
I did philosophy.
Did you have the intention before, after? And I also wonder, and this isn't to be presumptuous, but when one of five and the youngest, if that, I don't know if you're a natural performer.
Yes, I think trying to find your feet in a big family, looking for attention, I think definitely is part of it. I also think you're given a bit more freedom as the youngest, you know, where there's more pressure on you as an older sibling, where there's much less in a way. You're given more rope, as it were, to kind of experiment, and in my family were very open and giving in that way. But yeah, I didn't think about it, but it had been part of my life since I was a little one. You know, I'd always been doing it and performing it. I think, you know, my first memory was when I was 7, I think, in primary school, and I played King Herod, and I still remember it vividly. I had a whip, and I had a long kind of speech for a 7-year-old. And I remember the feeling of being in front of an audience and the fear and the nerves, but then also the deep satisfaction that it came to feeling like you could command attention, even if it was for a modicum of time.
And did you do kind of the fringe route when you were at uni? Did you try?
Yes, oh, definitely. Yeah, yeah. We did that. I love that. We did, we took comedy sketch groups up to Edinburgh Fringe every summer when we were at university.
Oh, I just think it's the most magical place in the world. Yeah. I love it. I've never taken a show, but I've always gone and enjoyed. And I think it's like a freedom that doesn't really exist anywhere else.
Yeah, it's such a fun, open, fertile ground with relatively low judgment. You know, you can do you can do anything, terrible or medium, in our case, and not be judged totally. And there's low pressure in that way. And I think people were open to experiment. So yeah, I love doing that. Yeah.
Okay, so when you're at drama school, how easy is it then to get your foot in the door? You know, it's an industry that from the outside looks impossible to get into. Yeah. So did you have a backup plan? What else are you doing to kind of monetize your life or finance your life?
Yeah, I mean, I went away and you know, traveled or whatever after school, and then I did my degree. And then afterwards, I was thinking naively, I wanted to be a musician. I'd been in lots of different bands, and I was sure that I was going to just make it, which was naive of me, because and lucky that I didn't try that route, because I definitely would have failed. But yeah, that was my first thinking. And then people were looking at these drama schools at the time, friends of mine, and I had no idea how to do it or how to be involved, but I ended up kind of auditioning, went to the Old Vic, and that was my way in, really. I don't know anyone else in the industry. My family are very far from this industry, so that was the first port of call, you know, and I was working part-time jobs and trying to pay off my student debt and stuff like that. And then they send people in, you know, and you kind of audition in front of them. And that was my first kind of door slightly ajar into it. And then you begin the hustle. And it's a hustle. It's a journey that you have to know that is going to be up and down and will continue to be up and down no matter what stage or age you are.
Dame Judi Dench said recently that she still gets scared that the phone isn't going to ring. And I'm thinking, you're Judi Dench,
the great Judi Dench, who is amazing and weirdly resembles my mum in some way, in all the best ways. A powerful force, but also soft and friendly. Yes, I think I can completely understand that. I mean, any freelance job, there's a little bit of that. But yes, there's always you're trying to be detached enough to live your life and do other things. But at the same time, you're kind of trying to use momentum and all those kind of things. But I think I'm kind of old enough and I've been doing it long enough that hopefully, you've got to accept that there's no magic pill. It's going to be good and fun sometimes, and it seems relatively smooth, and then other times it seems like a real battle.
This episode is brought to you by Twizzlers. Long day, late night, feeling a little bored? Twizzlers is the ultimate sidekick for any moment of the day, no matter what kind of day you're having. The perfect level of sweet and a fun excuse to sit back and relax. Unwind with Twizzlers. To buy now, visit Hersheyland.com/Twizzlers.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The 7-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. live, only on Netflix.
When you first start out, for example, when I was looking through your IMDb,
oh,
and it came up that you were in Downton Abbey and you were the guy that dies in Mary's bed, no?
Yes.
And I was like, oh my goodness, that's Theo James, which obviously I hadn't connected with at the time. When you are getting or you're landing those roles at the beginning of your career, does that really feel like a breakthrough? And do you remember your first time on set, what that was like?
I do. Do they feel like a breakthrough? No, not really. Because those kind of parts are really fun, but they're not, I don't think they're kind of going to change anything in a kind of, monumentous way. But I do remember my first time on set was a film and I got cut from the film. It was my first time on set, my first part I'd got. It was a tiny part. And I was Bryan Cranston's like kind of gimpy henchman, right? It was like three scenes or something. And he had to be talk. We was kind of, the first scene was a walk and talk. And he had to be like, what's the status or something like that? And I just had to kind of reel off some information. And I get to set. It's this vast thing. I'd literally never been on a set in my life. I didn't understand the mechanics of it. And the old Vic is very much Jacobean, Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. It's stagecraft, which is all good, but in terms of understanding it all. And I got there and I was totally overwhelmed by the size of it. And even the they didn't have an action that day. They had this giant set build. So for action, it was like a bang. that was action. And I must have looked at those words 1,000 times, there's no way I didn't know that tiny piece of dialogue. And the buzzer goes, ba-gang! I start walking with Bryan Cranston and I just completely dry. And that happens about 10 times. It was embarrassing thing. But that was my introduction into it. And then, you just have to learn to kind of buckle up after that.
Oh, goodness. I'm sorry. That sounds so
dramatic. But funny, though. Funny.
Now that you're successful enough, that could have been your moment. So you rose to fame playing Tobias Eaton in the Divergent series, which my dad loves, by the way, and that surprises
me. Your dad,
me
that does surprise me.
He's like into only war movies.
Interesting.
Watches Gold, UK TV. but he liked this, so we watched this together. When you shoot to fame in a big Hollywood YA series, and it makes you famous overnight with quite a young fan base or an obsessive fan base, not necessarily with the youth, but with press, et cetera, et cetera. What is that experience like? Because that's not just doing the job, that's also the fame element.
Yeah, that I found that tricky in some ways because I always wanted this to be a job. And I think increasingly the idea of celebrity and actor have become kind of mixed in a way which I didn't understand fully. So it was strange initially. I knew there was, with those kind of films, there's an immediate fervor which seems overwhelming, but then it kind of settles down. So I knew that, but at the same time, I wasn't fully prepared in terms of, I'm quite a private person naturally, and I wasn't fully prepared for the interest in, small elements of your own life completely removed from the job you're doing. I just assumed that it was about the job and some fun on the side, but it wasn't really about your personal life. That has changed now and probably changed forever. The sharing of personal details that actors go through has become a kind of just a piece of the architecture.
Yeah, part and parcel.
I'm not for you don't have to do that, but it is a bit of it. And that was almost the beginning of that. The zenith of YA with all those other YA. There was a load of them at the same time. So I wasn't really ready for it, but now I kind of understand it a little more.
Yeah, and I think it's difficult, isn't it? Because looking back, you're like, well, okay, that must have opened a lot of doors in some ways because it ricochets you into consciousness. But then also it has the downside of the elements of, like you're saying, that lack of privacy. And especially in an era of social media, I know you're not on social media, but I think maybe we do expect more from people, or we feel that people aren't actually 3D human beings. We just see them as public property. perhaps. Looking back, would you do anything differently?
Yeah, looking back, maybe I would have waited to do something like that because, you know, I like the idea of having more experience. But again, you can never, it's hard to kind of reflect really because you're hustling and trying to pay your bills. And at that point, I was still, you know, 5 years of university and gallons of debt. Yeah.
Also, two separate degrees.
Yeah, so exactly. Both useless. I'm not necessarily I would have done something different, but maybe I would have gone in with my eyes a little open, more open.
Also, you have your own production company.
Yes.
And has that also been to... I went on the Sanditon Series 2 and 3 set visit. It was my first and only set visit.
Oh, but that because you don't want to do them anymore?
Now I'm just in junkets with people like you. But I loved it and it was my first time and it was very cold, but thoroughly enjoyable. And I wondered if you got into production also to kind of diversify and get behind the camera a bit more and to give that kind of lens to your career.
Yeah, I think that was twofold. There was a reaction to wanting to be behind in the future more, perhaps, you know, wanting a bit more ability for control, a little trying to wrestle myself away from my own perceived, notch in the industry that I'd got myself into, and also feel a little bit more creative, I guess, in terms of building stories from the ground up. All the reasons that lots of actors get into it, really. But I enjoyed it, and I enjoyed the mechanics of it, and I enjoyed actually what it gave me was a greater understanding of the industry generally, which meant I was more relaxed as an actor as well, because you're so helpless in a way when you're an actor because you're just kind of waiting for the next gig and trying to hustle mm-hmm. for it. And there's a lot of fun in that. But at the same time, knowing a little bit of the machinery of the industry means that you know that it's not always personal.
When you say perceived notch, do you mean as in you felt a bit typecast?
Well, yeah, I think if you get yourself, you know, your first large kind of publicly known project, it's very common that you kind of have to diversify from that and dig yourself out of a place and into a new one, you know. And that's a little bit of a theme of this industry. You kind of have to keep reinventing as you get older and you change as an actor and you grow or you know everything about you changes. So that's a part and parcel of it. Yeah.
Before we come on to talk about The Gentleman, and I think this lends itself nicely because it's a somewhat similar role, although not the same character. Recently, you starred in Series 2 of White Lotus. We're seeing this renaissance, if you like, of these shows that unpick the wealthy. So White Lotus, Saltburn's done really well. The Triangle of Sadness is another example. Why do you think we're obsessed with these kind of unveilings or taking back of the rich?
Yeah, eat the rich, they say. I think probably it's a subconscious, it's twofold, I would say, in my own humble opinion. One is the deeper and greater gap between the hyper wealthy and the people who have nothing. And, you know, the longer we're in a kind of mostly dominant capitalist society, the deeper that stretch becomes. So the fascination with hyper wealth becomes even more interesting, but also even more frustrating for people. I also think Britain particularly moving into this sadly, you know, post-Brexit era, we're reflecting on the history of Britain and, you know, this idea of empire and wealth and mm-hmm. class divide and all those things. And I think there's a fascination in that. And then if I'd say a third thing, I think... hyper wealth is a fascinating way to kind of deconstruct someone's person, and it usually has a negative effect. So kind of watching that is gleeful, I would say.
White Lotus Series 2 was decidedly in quotations, sexier. And I was having a conversation recently with a few friends of mine, and we were looking at, I'm rewatching Game of Thrones at the moment. And when I watched it initially, I think I was slightly desensitized to the amount of nudity in it. I don't have a problem with nudity or anything like that, but rewatching it and now having heard about Emilia Clarke coming out saying that she didn't feel comfortable with some things and felt at the beginning of her career, she felt that she had to make those decisions to get those roles. I think we're more aware post Me Too that we have to really protect actors and also crew in these environments when they're having to do something that is sensitive. Mm-hmm. I wonder how you reflect on it and how it's changed over the course of your career.
I think thankfully it's changed a lot. I think post Me Too, you know, there's still a long way to go, but it has given some infrastructure in a world which is dominated by men. With White Lotus, I think Mike's idea was a thesis on sexuality. So mm-hmm. I never found, you know, I always thought it was tasteful and thoughtful because he's asking questions about human nature, about mm-hmm. carnality, about how we all engage in sex, how we all engage in our relationships. But certainly to analyze and to safeguard the way sex appears on screen and protect people, I think is tantamount. And luckily, it's just getting better. And I just hope that it continues to get better. Because I think a lot of women especially have often been in scenarios where they felt uncomfortable. And even if it's not, you know, the most obvious way, I think it happens all the time. Mm-hmm. And I think what Me Too did was, you know, the huge, horrendous perpetrators, obviously, there was a way of bringing them to justice, but it meant that generally as well, there was more of an eye on protecting people within an industry where they have to do things that can be very, put them in a very, you know, vulnerable place.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Let's talk about Gentlemen. I watched the first two episodes and I've had to stop myself because I know that my partner will absolutely eat this up. So I'm saving myself having to rewatch, but I absolutely loved it. How did the role come about? What appealed about it? And did it come, I don't know if you did it pre or post White Lotus, obviously very different roles, but again, that kind of rich man.
it was post White Lotus, I think before White Lotus had come out, and it was, I like the idea of Guy Ritchie. You know, I had obviously grown up, his first early films were had a huge effect on me. I remember I had the CDs, the soundtrack to Lock, Stock, to Snatch. I loved his kind of bombastic, stylish approach to things. Beyond that, I like the idea of deconstructing class, you know, and that's a kind of portentous way of saying something about the show, because it's, this show is about fun, really. But, you know, one of the lines struck me, it was in the first episode, but now I think it's in another episode, but it's essentially saying that lords constructed a system where they could stay in power and stay wealthy mm-hmm. for multiple generations and centuries. And that's so true in a way. Mm-hmm. And I also like the idea of the, you know, the dukedom, the upper class being dragged into the undergrowth of a society that they don't normally have to touch, and the satisfaction of that happening and them having metaphorical and literal blood on their hands.
I think that's so interesting because we are moving into an era where, you know, if we look at house prices, for example, cost of living crisis, it's all coming down to now generational wealth. If you want to get your foot on the property ladder, unless you've got, even if you've got a really, really good job, it's taking time. It's very, very difficult. And I think what was really interesting in this is that idea of passed down wealth, but then also with the cannabis farm, that idea of how to make new wealth in a society which hasn't made space for you mm-hmm. and how to almost monetize on where you are in your class system. Your character has inherited wealth and Kaya's character has
built wealth.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's, you know, and that's from the original movie, which is an interesting conceit, but to kind of deconstruct it a bit more, which we do in the show, is yes, it's the frailty of the old system dying. You know, you have this beautiful country house which is kind of falling apart and they can't afford it, and the career criminals come in and say, we have money, we've made money, we know that you don't have anything, you will be subservient to us. But you know, on the face of it, they are subservient to them. They have these weed farms underneath the ground in these posh estates, but ultimately they're reversing the kind of class system in a fun way. And I think that's what's quite enjoyable about it.
Yeah. I mean, it also, like you say, it's a very fun watch.
Yeah. The main thing is the fun of the watch. Yes, it's not.
Yeah, but I always think that the programs that do it best have an underlying message or there is something to sink your teeth into other than the ludicrousness of it, which, I mean, it's quite farcical at times.
Yes, and that's the high end, you know, and that's Guy's style in a way. He's able to blend the kind of hyper insanity, but then ground it. And that's one thing he was, you know, really good at. He was always like, it's a style that's always on the edge. It's a little heightened in places, but if you push it too far, then it becomes ridiculous. Then if you play it too solemnly and too, you know, too kind of grittily, it becomes like it's taking itself a little too seriously. Mm-hmm. So it's a very specific line to tread, and that's kind of what we love about his stuff.
Have you ever stayed in a country house like the one you filmed in?
No, never.
And what was it like filming it? Did you do all of the filming there?
We did a lot of the filming there. Yeah, interestingly, that is a real country house. The Duke of Beaufort lives there, and he's a real duke. And it's interesting to look him up. I don't think I met him, but it's fascinating because you forget that this exists in real life.
Yeah.
There's a Duke of Beaufort, and he has kind of some fun, salacious stories when you Google his name. And, you know, his wealth has been passed down, obviously, intergenerationally. So it really does exist, which is mad in this kind of modern era that we live in.
I know. Oh, gosh, yes. Okay, so obviously when we have, or when you enter the world of celebrity, and I'm only saying this because as a TV journalist, I have had some interesting experiences, you know, going to screeners or going to do all these fun things that seem slightly bonkers to the outside world as a celebrity. you must get the chance to go to lots of fun, exclusive events, parties. What's the most fun or ridiculous experience you found yourself in?
I don't know, really. I would say initially I was quite allergic to those things, but I've learned that, you know, A, you can have fun occasionally and don't take them too seriously. And B, you might need to check in every now and then with those kind of events. I've been finding, and I enjoy them, it's more fun the more people you know, if you know what I mean. It's either that or it's insane people watching, which my wife likes to do, is like, Jesus, who the hell is that? And being terrified to say hello. But we've been finding, honestly, in a very boring way, but it's hard to do when you've got children, because you're like, well, you want to put them down, but then you're going to get dressed up into these your glad rags and stuff, and that takes ages. So the logistics of it are becoming harder the older and more boring you become. But I couldn't think of the sexiest one I've been to, but they can be enjoyable if you choose the right one.
Okay, so in the series, your character's father has a very nice wine cellar. So fun question. What's the best wine you've ever drunk?
My dad's quite into wine in a fun way, and we enjoy talking and discussing wine a lot. In terms of, my brother lives in Australia, so I like New World wines as well. But, you know, I've had very fancy Bordeaux, and they are probably too sexy for me at this stage. I don't think my palate is developed enough. But interestingly, do you know that the female palate is more sensitive.
It's more taste buds.
Yeah, than the male. Yeah. So they're better in general, obviously as a gender, but you know, but just better winos generally.
Wow, okay. To finish up, what's your dream role?
I like the idea of playing Henry VIII.
Amazing.
I think I like the. I kind of find him fascinating. I think there's a way to learn about him which we haven't seen before, which I'd be interested in. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I look forward to watching that. Anyway, Theo James, thank you so much for coming on the Radio Times podcast.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed this episode, you might like to listen to my conversation with Sam Claflin or my interview with Penn Badgley. Both can be found by scrolling back through the Radio Times podcast feed.
Thank you for listening to the Radio Times podcast with me, your host, Kellyanne Taylor. Please do follow, rate and review wherever you get your podcast from. It helps other TV and film lovers find us. Until next Tuesday, happy viewing.